We're going to move on to our guest. It is James Corbett from the Corbett Report. James is located in Japan. He's been on the program, I don't know, half a dozen times in the past. James, are you there?
I am indeed, Alfred. Thank you so much for having me on again.
Oh, glad to have you. What's new in Fukushima? You're in Japan. Is Fukushima, you know, we hear, again, we get reports over here that are hyperbolic. The world is coming to an end. Is the world really coming to an end, or is it just being inconvenienced, or what's happening?
Well, I mean, I think it is, it's at this point, it's indeterminate to what extent the Fukushima crisis is really, has really created a problem. The thing that is not under dispute is the fact that it is an ongoing problem, that it still continues to leak radioactive substances out into the inlet there in Fukushima Bay and ultimately out into the ocean. That is a process that is continuing as the groundwater continues to flow through the reactors where the cores have melted down. So it is an ongoing concern at any rate. Some of the latest test data that's out by some of the groups that are out measuring this, including the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, show that there is no detectable Fukushima radiation on the west coast of the United States as of yet. But again, we would only expect it to begin washing up at this point, so one can expect that to probably reach detectable levels in the near future. But still, I don't think it's the type of world-ending event that some people are making it out to be, and it is not the everything is tickety-boo, wonderfully fine event that some people are making it out to be. I think the reality lies somewhere in the middle.
Well, that's usually the case. The worst-case scenario attracts the most listeners and the most viewers and the most readers, but it's also the least likely to happen. By definition, the worst is most, it'll likely be less than the worst. That's probably the way things are going to work out, and whether it'll be comfortable or it'll be terrible, or we'll watch and see, but it's not likely to be a worst case scenario. Here's something from the Agence France, Press, French newspapers. North Korea threatens nuclear strike on White House. Seoul, a top-ranking North Korean military official, has threatened a nuclear strike on the White House and Pentagon after accusing Washington of raising military tensions in the Korean Peninsula. Now, is North Korea simply some sort of a cartoon? Got the little short guy. Maybe he's even got a mini-me to hang out with him and the rest of that sort of thing with plans of taking over the world. Are these people genuinely dangerous, or are they just can't keep their mouths shut?
I think we have to take almost everything that's coming out of North Korea with a hefty grain of salt, not only because I think there is sort of a cartoonish element to the politics that is coming out of there and the rhetoric that is coming out of there that I think is probably more intended for a domestic audience than it really is to be taken seriously on the international stage. But also, I mean, I think that we have to be somewhat wary of some of the reports that do emerge from North Korea, because it is such a tightly controlled society that sometimes I think the reports that come out tend to be coming out through South Korean sources or Chinese sources that themselves are perhaps not completely trustworthy. For example, we had that story last year where supposedly Kim Jong-un fed his uncle to a pack of rabid dogs. And when you actually examine that story, it was almost certainly a fake. So there's a lot of those types of stories that get floated around. And there's a lot of bellicose rhetoric about nuclear strikes on Washington, etc. Of course, the North Koreans don't have the technological ability to deliver a nuclear warhead to Washington at this point. And even if they did have the ability to miniaturize their warheads, which again, they don't really have at this point, all they have is some really, I mean, nuclear firecrackers is all they've been able to demonstrate so far. And I don't want to undermine or downplay what they're doing, but it is on the bigger stage of what's happening in the world, it is certainly not big. I think North Korea, to a certain extent, to the extent that they're involved in this type of saber rattling, I think it is to keep world attention on them so that they can continue to keep various parties at the table and continue to try to play their hand in order to secure food aid and other things that they genuinely do rely on. And I think one of the big issues that's been really up in the air for years now has been the zone in the demilitarized zone where they have a joint South Korean-North Korean economic operation that that has been shut down and restarted on various times because one or the other group has pulled out or blocked access to the site. It's an ongoing concern, but obviously very, very important to North Korea and the North Korean economy, which has been so completely shut off from the rest of the world, both because of domestic concerns and also because of international pressure. So once again, it's a crazy situation, but it is, of course, the people at the bottom of that system that suffer the most from what's going on. So I think that the real concern here has to be the North Korean people and whether they will ever be able to escape the clutches of the regime that they're living under and all of the sanctions that have been imposed from the outside as well.
If North Korea doesn't pose any legitimate threat to the United States, at least certainly not Washington, D.C., is there reason to be concerned about North Korea relative to South Korea or Japan?
There certainly is. I mean, it's not to say that, again, it's not to say that North Korea has no ability to strike. And certainly if, I mean, they do have a massive military, and it's a question of how much of their military parades and things that they put on are papier-mâché, which has been a charge leveled at some of the rockets and things that they've displayed at some of those parades. But at any rate, they do have a large military. They do have many people in the army, and they certainly would be capable of launching a sudden strike at Seoul, which is not very far from the border at all. No. So it is at least possible that that North Korea could do something like that. Again, I'm not sure it would necessarily be in their interests unless, of course, this is just a rat that has been cornered in a corner of the room and is looking to escape and will do anything to strike out. I mean, I suppose that's always a possibility. So I wouldn't discount it completely as having the ability to strike against South Korea, even against Japan with some of their intermediate missiles that they've test launched a number of times now. But I just don't think it's a pressing concern for a lot of people here in East Asia who have learned, I think, to tune out a lot of the rhetoric that's coming from North Korea, which, again, I think is more intended for domestic audiences.
Yeah, crowd control. Domestic crowd control rather than actual warfare with a foreign country. I've got an article here from Investment Watch. And the headline is New MH17 Sensation. We're talking about the plane that was downed over Ukraine, the Malaysian airliner that was downed over Ukraine. New MH17 Sensation. German experts point finger at Ukrainian Air Force jets. And what they're claiming is that the evidence, in their opinion, suggests that it was not a surface-to-air missile that attacked the Malaysian airliner, because they found evidence of bullet holes in the cockpit of the remains of the Malaysian airliner, and they think that it was perhaps shot out of the sky and or taken down by an air-to-air missile that was on one of these aircraft. There have been reports that were two aircraft early on. A Spanish air traffic control reported that there were two Ukrainian fighter aircraft that were in direct contact with MH17. What do you think? Have you seen this information, and do you think it's credible, or do you think it's more fantasy, or what?
I certainly have seen it. I take it with a giant grain of salt, especially because that Spanish air traffic control report about the Ukrainian fighter aircraft came from Twitter, a Twitter account that was then suspended, and there was a big commotion in the alternative media at the time. Oh, look, there was this Spanish national who was working in Ukrainian air traffic control at the time, and he was leaking this information out on Twitter, supposedly, and saying that Ukrainian authorities had come to basically take over the air traffic control and things of that sort. And that turned out to be, as far as I know, a hoax. That was actually a Twitter account that was being run out of London by some hoaxer. So I take this all with giant grains of salt. Again, there's just so much speculation and other things that have been floating around about this. And until I see and there are credible, I mean, analysis of these cockpit holes, Again, I'm just not going to put all of my faith in a report like this, but it's certainly a possibility. And until I think we actually get the actual conversations with air traffic control and MH17, until we get those conversations released, which as far as I know, they have not been so far, I don't think we'll have anything of a real handle on what really went down. From my own analysis, the most...
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll have to continue with this in a second, James. We're going to have to break for some commercials, and we'll be back on Financial Survival with James Corbett from The Corbett Report in just a moment. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adask here on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest today is James Corbett from The Corbett Report, which you can find at Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. James has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started the Corbett Report website in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. And he's also editorial writer for the International Forecaster, a weekly newsletter created by recently deceased economic analyst Bob Chapman. So when we broke, we were talking about what's happening in Ukraine relative to the Malaysian flight that was shot out of the air one way or the other. And you've made the point that you don't want to jump to a conclusion until you've seen adequate evidence. How do you compare your reluctance to jump to conclusions without seeing adequate evidence to the eagerness we've seen in the United States and the government of Ukraine to say it's the Russians? The Russians did it. The Russians. I mean, I saw Hillary Clinton blaming the Russians the same on Charlie Rose the same day the plane went down. And I don't think anyone had any evidence to speak of at the time.
Certainly not. And you're exactly right about that. They often say that the action is to be found in the reaction. And I think that's the case in a scenario like this. And to a certain extent, you might say at the end of the day, it doesn't particularly matter. I mean, of course it does matter and we should be concerned about the truth. But from the perspective of the reaction, it doesn't actually even matter precisely how the plane was taken down. It matters how that is used propagandistically to promote one or another course of action. So that, for example, I mean, within 30 minutes, there were headlines already blazing about Putin and Russian involvement in this, where obviously there could not have been proof of any sort at that particular moment that the press was
how
running
could they
with.
Have known it wasn't a bomb on the plane.
Exactly. Could it could have been any number of things.
A mechanical failure on the plane, a catastrophic failure on the plane. I mean, which tells us what? Insofar as they jump to these conclusions so eagerly, what does that imply?
Well, I think that one of the things that we can say is that certainly in the weeks preceding this takedown of MH17, there were a number of planes, or at least a couple of the AN-26s that were taken down by the rebels with some of their, some of their Stinger missiles, which of course was not used in this case, but they had managed to get some of the low-flying Ukrainian military aircraft in the weeks preceding this. So I think there was already the sense in the region that that plane crashes are related to the fighting that's going on. So I think that narrative had already been somewhat laid, the groundwork had been laid for it, so that there was the ability for media outlets to sort of jump that gun and run to that conclusion. At least they could point to some of these incidents in the past. And that leads me to my own analysis. Again, take it for what it's worth, and I think we have to withhold our judgment on this until we have all the evidence. But I think the most likely scenario, given what we do know about what was happening on the ground in the weeks leading up to this, is that it probably was taken down. I would say probably by the rebels on the rebel side, with their anti-aircraft technology, likely supplied by the Russians, but certainly not as an intentional takedown of a civilian aircraft, which of course makes absolutely no sense. It is completely counterproductive from the side of the rebels or the side of Moscow. They have no interest whatsoever in taking down a civilian aircraft unless they were simply trying to get the entire world opinion turned against them. I think this was likely the result of a strategy that we've been seeing that has been used in that region in recent weeks and months of the Ukrainian military hiding their military aircraft behind civilian flights. And there are multiple cases of people talking about this, that basically the military aircraft would use civilian aircraft kind of as covers or shields for them to conduct their bombing operations on eastern Ukraine. And in fact, there was a deleted BBC report that you can still find on YouTube. Someone managed to preserve it and put it up on YouTube. It's up there right now under the headline, "The Video Report Deleted by the BBC." And in that report, they interview several eyewitnesses to the MH17 takedown that were talking about Ukrainian military aircraft that were flying in tandem with that civilian aircraft. So again, I think it's very likely that that rebels were targeting the military aircraft and ended up hitting a civilian aircraft. I can't say that with any definitive certitude, but it is certainly it is in line with those types of eyewitness reports. And again, it's very telling that the BBC actually did take that report down and scrubbed it, or tried to scrub it and put it down the memory hole, when they realized that wasn't going to play well in terms of the narrative that's being created about the evil Russians taking down a civilian aircraft.
Do you think there are any secrets left in the digital world, in the internet world? Is it possible to maintain secrets?
It is becoming more difficult, but unfortunately it does give rise to its own problems, which of course is the deliberate seeding of misinformation or certainly intelligence operations might make use of these types of incidents to plant a story and then retract it, because then that looks suspicious. But of course you can never really retract anything on the internet, so people find it. I mean, one could imagine how this could be used for various black operations by intelligence agencies that were inclined to do so. So it brings with it its own problems, but I think on the whole, it is a good thing that we live in this era of information where we really do have access to so much more information than we would have before. Can you imagine if this incident had taken place even as little as 20 years ago? I think we wouldn't have anywhere near the amount of sources or information on this that we do at this particular time, and we would be beholden to a CNN or what have you to provide all of the information we would have on this.
It's one of the, it's a double-edged sword. It's a sort of thing, it's a blessing and perhaps also a curse. You know, if you want to find out anything about me when I was in grade school, you're going to have to go all the way back to the town where I grew up and kind of unearth it on your own. You're going to have to play detective or, you know, archaeologist or whatever to find out what you can. But today, kids are putting things up on the internet that will potentially haunt them for the rest of their lives. And that's interesting. Just from a psychological perspective, I look at that and think, how strange. You know, you forget things back when I was a kid, what you did last week is almost forgotten. Huh? But today, it might last forever. You think that's having an effect on children that's significant? Have they become a little bit cautious, or are they unwise? They haven't picked up on the possibility that the stunts they pull today may still be on the internet and haunting them 40 or 50 years from now?
Well, it can't help but have an effect on the society, and I would say it's an example of social engineering, and I guess we could, you know, debate whether there is an engineer behind this process, and if so, you know, who that might be and for what purpose. But at any rate, the process is taking place right now where people are becoming basically more and more apt to put these types of things out on the internet without a second thought. And there of course, there are issues that come up from time to time, and these types of debates happen. But regardless, people still continue to use these social media that we now know are not only being used explicitly by, for example, the Department of Homeland Security and other government agencies, which explicitly monitor social media and have programs set up and have solicited companies for programs to monitor social media and things of that sort. But now we also know, for example, Facebook was conducting psychological experiments on its own user base by selecting certain types of stories to put in people's feeds in order to see how that affected their moods and things of this sort. I mean, we know this information is being used, and yet still, I mean, there's a billion plus people on Facebook at the moment. So that's a pretty sad indictment for our sense of privacy as a culture, as a society. And again, that can't help but have profound ramifications on the way that children are growing up to see themselves in the world and to see the notion of privacy. And of course, just one of the implications of this that's now making the headlines with somewhat more regularity, there's this idea of quote-unquote revenge pornography that they're trying to make various laws to try to head off at the pass, as basically it becomes more and more common for young couples to take various types of explicit sexual pictures, and then of course those pictures to be used as blackmail or simply used to try to denigrate people after the fact. And of course that again hangs around for the rest of eternity. The moments folly in one's youth can now haunt one forever, and it's certainly not something that I think enough young people are really explicitly aware of. And of course that's just the nature of youth. I mean, I think we all remember back to when we were young and silly and can only imagine if everything we were doing was being recorded for all posterity. It would be cringeworthy to think about. And unfortunately, there is a generation growing up right now that does have to think about that. So it is a process of cultural engineering. And I guess the question is, how do you really escape that? Because it is so fundamental to the society that we're living in that people are really entered into this by default.
I think we're going to see a time, there's a generation who has been irresponsible, imprudent, celebratory in their use of the internet and cell phones and cell cameras and so on. I think they're going to become extremely prudent. About the time they get to their 30s and they begin to see some of this stuff catch up with them, I think they are going to devise ways to maintain secrecy. If it means they only talk to other people in a closet, but they're going to find a way to talk to each other and communicate and get on with their lives in ways where they're going to work hard to try to be invisible, or at least I suspect that might be true. I've got an article here from The Sovereign Man, written by Simon Black, and he reports that the richest man in Asia is selling everything in China. And he says there's a man, Li Kai Shing, allegedly the richest man in Asia, and he started investing in the 80s, and he is now recently dumping all of his stocks and properties in Asia. It says after years of unprecedented monetary expansion that has put the economy in a precarious state, the Chinese government has been desperately trying to rein in credit growth, and it goes on. And apparently this extremely wealthy man, again, Li Kai Shing, he's saying, I'm out of here. Do you think he's making a sensible judgment of what the immediate economic future is for China, or is he overreacting?
Well, it does raise the question if China can really continue to play the game that they've been playing in recent years. And that game has really been just expanding the credit bubble to pick up the slack on the sort of industrial and productive activity that led it to the boom in the first half of the last decade. That has really been maintained for the last 5 or 6 years by an incredible credit boom. Basically, China's overall supply of credit in their banking system went from $9 trillion 5 years ago to $25 trillion today. And we see China right now trying to ease off on that and trying to close that spigot. We see them dropping reserve purchases in terms of reserve currencies and buying foreign bonds. We see that dropping from $106 billion a quarter down to $27 billion a quarter. So they're tightening up that way. They've been trying to tighten up regulations on their shadow banking system and try to get that under control. So China is definitely trying to move their economy from that industrial export-based economy to the credit-fueled boom economy to a domestic demand economy. And I think that process is going to be very delicate, and there is every possibility of that process derailing spectacularly and things going very wrong as that bubble doesn't just start to shrink, but actually pops. And that, of course, is something that I'm sure some investors are definitely taking into account. And I wouldn't say they would be wrong to be very cautious about what's happening in China right now as they do try to ease off on that gas pedal.
When we talk about a credit boom in China, has that credit boom been intended for the entrepreneurs and the businessmen and the industries? They add credit? Or was this credit boom intended, in other words, the credit was there to foster the industrialization of China? Was that the fundamental reason for the credit boom? Or was the credit boom intended to make credit more available to consumers and thereby shift to a consumer-based economy? Did they start handing out Visa cards and debit cards and so on, say, go out and buy yourself a car? It'll be good for our economy. We'll move to a consumer economy, and we're going to give you credit to get there. Do you see my point?
I do, and this credit boom has definitely been weighted towards the development of infrastructure projects, construction, things of that nature. So there has been incredible amounts of construction that's gone on in China over the past several years that have been fueled by this credit boom, which, of course, has had knock-on effects in the economy, obviously, first and foremost to the construction contractors themselves, but then to related industries. But to the extent to it that it is filtered down to the average person, certainly the sort of rising tide floats all boats or rises all boats in the harbor is true to a certain extent, and there has been an overall increase in the standard of living. But I think much of that has basically been accrued at the very top with a certain class of entrepreneurs and others who have been connected and able to access that credit, who have been who have become quite wealthy, and still a lot of people at the very bottom of that system that are working in near slave-like conditions at Foxconn and what have you. So I think it has not really filtered down to that consumer level to that extent yet. There are certain wealth management products, as they're called, that are available through the shadow banking system that offer 10% yields and what have you to the average kind of banking customers and consumers. But those are very shaky products, and we've seen possibilities of defaults in that in recent months. So again, it's a very precarious situation. And although this boom has led to certain well-connected people becoming quite wealthy, it hasn't really yet, I think, started that to really spur that domestic demand that would be necessary to maintain the types of growth that we've seen in recent years.
All right, let's take a break for some commercial announcements, and we'll come back and I want to know whether the consumers in China, are they likely to riot or to be angry, upset, whatever, with government because they're not being brought in quick enough? We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Alfred Addis here with James Corbett from The Corbett Report. Financial Survivor. Stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis, and this is Financial Survival, and we're talking to James Corbett. He's talking to us from Japan. He is the author of The Corbett Report. You can find it on the internet at CORBETTREPORT.com. CorbettReport.com. Two T's. Talking about China, and I'm wondering if the credit boom that's made some people rich doesn't extend down to the average Chinese, and the government is apparently trying to rein in this credit boom. Are the average Chinese going to become overly jealous of those who took advantage of the credit boom? Are they going to become angry at China's government that they want a chunk of a bigger piece of the pie? What do you think?
Well, I think your question is well placed, because it certainly, I mean, there's obviously a relation between political stability of a country like China with 1.3 mm-hmm. billion people and the economic situation of the country, so that it is, you know, when things are booming and when credit is expanding and people are generally doing better than before, there will be that political stability that helps to grease the skids for the regime in power. But when that starts to unwind, I think we could definitely see political instability as a result. And one would assume that there would be a lot of the people who did kind of miss out on the credit expansion that's been going on, who would be very resentful. So I think we would see those types of fault lines developing. At this point, I don't think that we do see that. I think there is a relative stability in the political system right now, because regardless of whether people are doing, you know, much better or only slightly better than before, at any rate, they're doing better, and the economy is still continuing to expand, even if it is just a credit-fueled expansion. It really is the point at which that seizes up and even starts contracting that I think we'll see the real political points come to the head, although we have already seen some very interesting developments in the Xinjiang region of northwestern China, which is a economically quite depressed but strategic area of China, not only for the crossroads that it forms in the so-called New Silk Road that connects China to East to Central Europe, Central Asia, but also some of the potential resources that are there to be developed still in that region. And so we see that there is a Uyghur Muslim minority in that region that has more and more become restive in recent months and has really stepped up a terror campaign that's going on right now. Multiple sort of large attacks, bombings, train station knifings and things that have caused quite a bit of bloodshed, not only there in Xinjiang, but in some of the other regions there in China that has caught the international attention. And I think there are certain aspects of that tension, which is economic in nature as well, as the Uyghur Muslim minority has definitely been excluded from a lot of economic opportunity and find it very difficult to make their way anywhere else in China. It's very difficult for a Uyghur, for example, to make their way to Beijing and start a business. So I think there is an element in which the economic effects of the way that Xinjiang is being developed is already causing certain political instability. And it's going to be very interesting to see how Xi Jinping really ends up dealing with this and whether the new types of anti-terror legislation that China is thinking about bringing in will have similar effects on China as the Department of Homeland Security, etc., has had on the United States.
You mentioned development in this province, administrative district, I'm not sure what you call it, but Xinjiang, if I'm saying it correctly. Does this economic development, is it primarily enriching people who are native to that province? Or is this economic development primarily enriching people that are coming from, say, Peking? Well, and they're moving in.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly the point. There are, certainly, if it was the case that it was enriching the local Uyghur Muslim population, I think there would be probably less sort of resentment of the development that's going on. But I actually had the chance to interview Pepe Escobar, who's visited the region a number of times on my program a few months back. And he was talking about the ways in which basically people from Beijing or some of the other Shanghai or some of the wealthier parts of China can get on a train and go to Xinjiang and go there and start up a business quite easily and can interact with the Chinese governmental offices and bureaucracy in the region quite easily, whereas it's much harder for one of the local Uyghur Muslims to do the same. So it certainly is skewed towards the Han Chinese ethnic majority of the country, who are the ones who can come in and literally just step off the train and basically start a business, as opposed to the local population, which continues to suffer economically. So there definitely is a disparity there, and I think that definitely increases the tensions that already exist there between the Uyghur minority and the Han Chinese majority.
I look at China. I've never been there, and I can only guesstimate what's going on there. I haven't, but from the outside, it impresses me that they've been able to maintain an apparent stability for a considerable, I mean, perhaps centuries. They've managed to hold this country together despite a multitude of minorities. What's the secret of their success?
Well, it is a remarkable feat of cultural engineering, isn't it? And I mean, like yourself, I'm looking at this mostly from the outside. I've been to China, but only a few times, and so I don't have that sort of local grasp of it. But I think that there just has been, for thousands of years, when you look at the various emperors that have ruled over the Chinese population, I think that there has been a sort of acceptance of top-down rule in the Chinese society that is occasionally threatened, and certainly there are, I mean, there we do see elements, riots and things that break out occasionally, but there is a remarkable degree of control that's maintained, and it has been maintained at obviously at the end of a barrel of a gun for a very long time, and obviously we can look to things like the Tiananmen massacre as examples of that. But I really do think in the last couple of decades that sort of order and stability has really been maintained because of the promise of the economic expansion that's been going on, mm-hmm. which is why I think, especially because, I mean, it's somewhat easier, I think, to keep an economically quite depressed population in check than it is to keep a population that at least has sort of tasted that idea of something more like an American middle class dream. I mean, obviously, it's quite different in the Chinese context, but something like that, and people who have tasted a little bit of that type of entrepreneurial spirit and the idea of improving their lot in life, to have that suddenly taken away from them would be, I think, quite politically destabilizing. So in that respect, I think that this might be one of the more delicate situations that the Chinese government has found itself in for a very long time, because now they're no longer dealing with a mostly rural peasant population that's just used to economic depression. They're now dealing with a population that is increasingly urbanized and increasingly looking for those types of rooms for economic advancement. So if Xi Jinping and the Communist Party doesn't play their cards right and doesn't provide that type of, at least the notion that opportunity is there, then I really do think that this could be a chance for some profound political change in China in the future.
You were talking about the economic expansion that's been taking place in China for the last, at least decade. You could probably trace it back 20 years or more. But it's resulted in an enormous amount of pollution. And we've seen reports here in the United States, I've seen reports, that pollution started rising to some measurable degree in California. And they started searching for the source, people in charge of air quality, and where was it coming from? And they realized it was coming all the way from China, clear across the Pacific Ocean. Now, you're on the west coast of Japan, if I understand correctly, and China is essentially across that narrow, relatively narrow body of water. What sort of pollution do you experience that you can trace to Japan? Is it a significant issue or not as bad as we've been led to believe?
It is a significant issue, and it does have identifiable, visible effects here in Japan. And one of those are the yellow dust, the yellow sand that comes across from the dust storms in the Gobi Desert, which actually find their way to Japan. I remember a few years ago seeing one morning the sort of yellow sand dust type thing covering cars on the street and wondering what it was and being surprised to find, oh yeah, that's from China, and everyone here knows about it. And I was like, oh, I didn't know that. But of course, beyond just those sort of natural phenomenon, of course, now in recent years, we've seen more and more of the air pollution and things of that nature making their way across to Japan as well. And so there's a greater emphasis on these so-called PM2.5, I believe it is, these small particles that have huge effects on people's lungs. In fact, the Chinese health ministry has come out to say that industrial pollution itself is the cause of the leading cause of death in China, which is cancer. So even the Ministry of Health in China admits this. And of course, it has effect, including acid rain in Seoul, in Tokyo, in other parts of this region. So it is definitely a concern. And it is actually quite a large political concern in China. I remember when I was there in Beijing, reading about it in the newspaper every day, especially at that time, it was a very large issue in terms of the daily readings of the PM2.5 particles and whether, you know, how dangerous it was that particular day. And it's certainly an ongoing political issue. And one of those pressure points that might be one of those issues that people don't necessarily think about. You think about more like people being repressed by the Chinese PLA and, you know, living at the point of a gun and things of that nature. But these are the types of things that affect people on a daily basis that you don't necessarily think about that could have that type of profound effect. So I think China is going to, at some point, have to start curtailing not only the industrial pollution, which is certainly a factor, but also some of their business practices. I mean, obviously, with the kind of entrepreneurial spirit that's being fostered in China as well, comes a lot of very unscrupulous business people who will use all sorts of things, including literally making cooking oil from sewage, raw sewage, and things of that nature, which happens, and all sorts of things of that sort, including a scandal that's just recently broken here in Japan and in other places in East Asia, where there was a Chinese supplier of chicken for McDonald's restaurants in East Asia that was found to be using expired chicken, and that's become a big scandal. There's food scandals of that sort on a regular basis here in Asia because of these Chinese practices. So there is going to have to be some reining in of this at some point. And again, I mean, there's going to be economic and political ramifications to these types of issues.
China, what's China's government, the government of China, what's their position on pollution? I know they're going to give lip service to the idea that the pollution has to be reduced. But do you suppose that there's any secret appreciation for pollution insofar as it reduces their population?
Well, that, of course,
you understand it's a conspiracy theory. Do you think it's a valid conspiracy theory or just completely irrational?
Well, given that this is the same government that has enforced a one-child policy, I mean, more or less, for decades, and has mobile abortion vans that they go to take care of people who have exceeded their limit of children, etc. I mean, certainly this is a government that has a displayed and absolutely undeniable lack of regard for human life, even the lives of their own citizens. So to the extent that there may be a certain depopulation effect here that at any rate isn't discouraged, if not actively encouraged, I certainly wouldn't put it past the Chinese government. And that is particularly worrying because, as we've talked about before, China has been explicitly called a model for the New World Order by people like Soros and others, including, of course, David Rockefeller, who penned an obituary to Chairman Mao back in the New York Times in the 1970s, where he said the great legacy of Chairman Mao is the great social experiment that was conducted, by which, of course, presumably he was referring to the Great Leap Forward, etc., which has been estimated to have accounted for 30, 40, 50 million. I mean, no one has an exact number, but tens of millions of Chinese died during that so-called great social experiment. And this is explicitly the model that some of these very influential people in the West have been looking to. So I think that there is definitely a dark undercurrent to this that needs to be examined. And perhaps, I mean, perhaps some of this is fostered or encouraged or at least allowed to happen because it does have that effect of taking care of some of the surplus populations, quote unquote.
We've got about a minute left. Why don't you give folks an idea of where they can see the video that you put together? Tell us a little bit about how it's doing on the internet and also give us contact information. We've got about 45 seconds left.
If you're referring to my documentary on the Federal Reserve, it now has over 112,000 views on YouTube. Again, I'm exceptionally happy about that. Again, for a 90-minute documentary on monetary policy, I'm glad to see that there are so many people that are interested. If people out there are interested, haven't seen it yet, please go to CorbettReport.com/Federal Reserve, all one word, Federal Reserve. You can watch it. You can read the transcript. You can purchase a DVD copy if you want to support the work. It's all up there, 100% freely available for download, and I hope people will find it that way. You can also contact me through the contact form on CorbettReport.com if you want to get in touch with me directly.
All right, James, thanks very much for your time. Thanks for being on the program. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer, and James Corbett. Bye-bye.
All night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay.
Ain't it sad?
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me.
That's too bad.